about how we began publishing your What the Buddha Never Said column.
Sure. That sounds like a good place to start.
For years, we heard people quoting the Buddha, and we often discovered, whether it was through letters or online, that the Buddha had never really said these things. And we found also, we have a lot of people helping us, and we publish something that the Buddha said, or we say the Buddha said. We can easily access scholars and teachers, and certainly scholars of the texts who will tell us this is correct or not. But most people don't have that kind of access. And I have to acknowledge that we have made mistakes ourselves. For years, we were running a quote that we claimed was by Albert Einstein, saying that if ever there was a religion of the future, it was Buddhism, and he gave various reasons for that. It was sort of something that Toynbee said, in fact, but it certainly wasn't that either. And a scholar wrote me and said, James, can you source this? And this is before Google. So we spent a lot of time finding out how incorrect we actually were. So when Bodhipaksha started writing his blog, what the Buddha, the things the Buddha never said.
Well, fake Buddha quotes.
Yeah, fake Buddha quotes. We launched a column, What the Buddha Never Said, and Bodhipaksha obliged us and began pulling out popular quotes that were ordinarily attributed to the Buddha that, in fact, the Buddha never said. And there are reasons for these misunderstandings. Often they're self-serving. Sometimes they're simple mistakes. Sometimes they're misreadings. But most often they come from other traditions. They're either Hindu, they're more in line with the Hindu tradition, or they're more in line with, say, the Transcendentalists, the American Transcendentalists, or the Romantics. And as with any culture, as we take on the Buddha's teachings, we're going to spin it in a way that resonates with our own cultural framework. So it was a lot of fun to look at things that people thought the Buddha said that he in fact never said. And maybe you can say what inspired you to begin this in the first place.
Well, I'll do that, but before I do, you've also had some other interesting articles as well, along the lines of what the Buddha never said. You've had articles by Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhikkhu Thanissaro, I think, looking at specific teachings that tend to be interpreted in a certain way, and they're pointing out that actually that's not probably the way that the Buddha meant them.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote about, we often hear people say the Buddha taught one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering, which sounds like two things anyway. But even so, the Buddha didn't really say that. I mean, he certainly taught a lot more than that. And Bhikkhu Bodhi acknowledged that he himself had made that mistake many times. And then he explains in this column why, in fact, that's a misunderstanding, or rather a misreading. And in this particular case, it was a misreading based on a misunderstanding of a few Pali words, a few key Pali words that seem to be very insignificant, but really change the entire meaning of that statement. We have an upcoming article by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who many of you know. He can sometimes be rather polemical. But he is writing an article about interconnected but not one. You often hear people say we are all one. Mm. Is that really a Buddhist idea? And is that not more of a reference to Atman? We are all one. Or how do we understand that statement? And did the Buddha ever really say we are all one? So Bodhipaksha actually inspired us to ask others to contribute in this regard as well. But why don't, I'm going to throw it back at you for a moment. I'll ask the expert here. Did the Buddha ever say we are all one?
No. He actually said the opposite of that. I mean, there is the question, of course, of, what did the Buddha say? And we can never know what the Buddha said, because all we have are texts which are written down a few hundred years after. And the texts we know were messed around with in the period between him being alive and them being written down. They were politicized. There were scholars among the monks who were trying to make sense of those teachings and interpret them, and they were putting their own spin on the teachings. They're as close as we can get. But I think the thing is, you can never say the Buddha said, if you can't find it in the scriptures. That's all you can really come back to, is that you can't find these things in the scriptures. And in the scriptures, the Buddha was asked whether everything was all one, and he said, no, you can't say everything is all one, but neither can you say that everything is different. He said that existence is not... This isn't a quote, by the way, this is me paraphrasing, because this is another way that fake Buddha quotes get into circulation, is because somebody says, the Buddha said, and then they paraphrase the Buddha, and someone takes that, you know, the bit in quotation marks, and takes that as being something that the Buddha actually said, which is often quite different from what he said. Anyway, he said, in effect, that existence is not a unity, but neither is it a multiplicity. He said that both of those were false views. And I take that to mean that everything is indefinable, really. I mean, you can take anything that we perceive, you and me, self and world, and you can see ways in which we arise in dependence upon each other. The world arises in dependence upon me, I arise in dependence upon the world. So there's an interrelationship between those things. And it's tempting to merge that down into a oneness, but the Buddha seemed to think that that was not an accurate way to look at things. But neither can you say that things are separate from each other. Anyway, that was a very specific one.
Right. Well, I think that saying that everything is conditioned and doesn't exist without reference to something else or dependent upon something else is very different, in fact, from saying it's one.
It is, yeah. You're basically saying nothing exists in isolation. Nothing is definable. You can't find the edges of anything.
Right. The danger there, though, as we discussed earlier, is that does not point in the direction of nihilism. That does not mean that things are not important or that they don't exist any more than it means that they essentially exist. There's, again, the middle way, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, you know, we're publishing this, it's kind of funny, the upcoming issue is going to contain a special section on Buddhism and self-help, because often Buddhism is understood to be self-help, and, you know, I have no quarrel with self-help. If a particular practice relieves someone's immediate suffering, certainly I have no... that has to be a good thing. But when Buddhism is understood as nothing more than self-help, I think we miss the teachings and the their power and their liberative potential. So in this issue, and it is not yet published, so I have a kind of a shoddy piece of paper. It just went to press today. And so I want to read a few of them because I think they're pretty funny because, in fact, people do often associate them with Buddhism. And this is a sidebar by Bodhipaksha, and we call it What the Buddha Never Said About Self-Help. And one in particular is, the whole secret of existence is to have no fear. Some people think that, in fact, is a Buddhist quote, and you could probably trick someone to thinking it is. What do you have to say about that one?
Well, the Buddha never talked in terms of there being a secret of life. It's very interesting when I was researching that one, and I thought, that's an interesting expression, just that there is a secret, you know, to life. And I tried to find out, you know, how far back that actually went, and it doesn't actually go back particularly far. I think maybe it goes back to the 19th century. It's definitely not the kind of idea that you would find in Buddhism. And the Buddha did talk about fear, but he didn't suggest that that was the one thing that was somehow key to practice.
Was that a Vivekananda quote, I think?
It was. It's actually a quote from the late 19th century.
Right.
And it was Vivekananda, who was of course a Hindu teacher. And quite a lot of self-help quotes are actually from Hindu sources.
Right. It's interesting because the transcendentalists, for instance, Thoreau and Emerson, when they first heard about the Buddha, they had very little to work with. Very little had been translated, and really they had a very impressionistic view of who the Buddha was historically and what the tradition taught. And often the way they understand it was more Christian or Hindu than anything else, because when you say, for instance, all we're all one, it's this notion of one no longer being separate from God, say, or Atman. So, you know, the Romantics in Tanisaro Bhikkhu, again, is very interested in this and has just come out with a book about this. It's online at Access to Insight. He talks about the relationship with people's understanding of Buddhism and misunderstanding it for 19th century Romanticism. Mm-hmm. But I just want to really quickly read one more, and then I'll leave you alone. Happiness does not depend on what you have or who you are. It solely relies on what you think. It's another one that sort of sounds Buddhist.
It sounds kind of Buddhist, but unfortunately one of the reasons that it sounds very Buddhist is because it fits in with a lot of other quotes which are not Buddhist, but people think the Buddha said.
That's interesting.
There are translations of the Dhammapada, the first couple of verses of the Dhammapada, which say things like, you know, everything arises and depend upon what you think, or the world arises in dependence upon our thoughts, and that kind of thing, which is not what it actually says at all. I'm ashamed to say I can't quite remember what it is at the moment, but it's essentially saying, you know, all experience arises in dependence upon the mind. But this is a way of looking at things that really dates back to the late 19th century and the, you know, the self-help movement, that thinking is really key, and if you can just, you know, change your thoughts, then you'll change your reality. I mean, that kind of way of talking about things is very familiar to us. The Buddha was much more focused. Yes, he did talk about, you know, the need for us to to change our thoughts and to encourage skillful thoughts as opposed to unskillful ones. But if there was one thing that he would have pointed to as being crucial, it would have been action is what we do, that karma, basically karma.
Right. We talked about this earlier. There are a lot of Buddhists who are under the impression that everything that happens to one is karmic, that everything in your life and everything that you experience and everything that you do is the result of karma, and certainly the Buddha never said that either.
No, that was something that he actually specifically said was a wrong view, that everything that happens to us is a result of karma. Karma he defined as intention. Karma is chetana, it's intention. So it's the action. I mean, karma literally means action. It's the action of choosing what kind of actions you're going to do, or what kind of thoughts you're going to have, what kind of emotional responses you're going to respond to the world with.
You know, often an overemphasis on karma, I think, and there will be a question and answer period, I think, and you may have something to say about this too, but also it has profound and sometimes very negative social consequences. Mm. In other words, a person's social standing or position in society, as you know, in the caste system, would therefore be rationalized by saying that the person somehow or another did something in the past to result in their particular form of suffering. And I would say, for instance, racism
The caste system in India, which is racism.
Or poverty. People are poor because of something they've done in an earlier life. And in fact, there are Buddhists who are proponents of this view. Yeah. I think it's probably a little bit more common in some traditions than others. I think it's probably less so in the Pali tradition. Mm. But do you have any comments about that? I just thought it was very interesting because I have heard teachers whom I have respected say things that, as a Westerner, I found quite jarring.
Yeah, because it can be quite jarring. I mean, I've heard Buddhists who've been asked about the Holocaust, for example, and said, well, does this mean that, you know, Jews did something bad? And they said, well, yeah, they must have.
Right.
They must have done something to deserve that, which is really quite, you know, unconscionable as a way of looking at things. At the same time, I don't think most Buddhists who hold that view, that everything is a result of karma, are necessarily uncompassionate at all. I think probably in their everyday dealings, they just generally respond, someone is poor, someone is sick, And you know, they respond with compassion to that. So I don't think they actually think it through or take it through to its logical consequence.
Well, I think also, yeah, when they experience sickness or misfortune, they likewise think that it has something to do with what they've done in the past. It's a rather simplistic view of karma, which is actually a very sophisticated articulation of intention.
Well, the early Buddhist tradition actually kind of worked up the idea of conditionality, because there's a general principle of conditionality that this thing gives rise to that. On the basis of this, that arises. And karma is one particular example of that. That's how our experience of life unfolds in dependence upon the kind of particularly ethical choices that we make, whether we choose to dwell upon the world in a grasping way or in a way that relates to the world through ill will, or whether we're consciously cultivating qualities like mindfulness and loving kindness. So karma is just one particular strand of that. And the early tradition outlined five different forms of conditionality, which all interact with each other. So you've got what you could call the physical inorganic form of conditionality, which is basically just physics and chemistry. You know, the sun comes up and it warms the atmosphere and it causes evaporation and it causes rain to happen and it warms us up. And you know, the sun does not arise in dependence upon our karma. It's just something that's happening. There was a biological form of conditionality as well. So certain plants will give rise to certain fruits. Those fruits will give rise to certain plants. I'm waving my hands around a lot, I noticed. There's what they call the mental level of conditionality, which is not karmic. It's more like, I suppose, ordinary psychology. Things like the way groups tend to operate, the way societies tend to operate, the kind of cultures that evolve in societies, that kind of thing would all fall under that heading. And then there's karma, which is when we become aware of how our minds are working, and then we're able to make choices about that. And then there's a final form of conditionality, which is dharmic conditionality, I think was what they called it. And basically, that's what happens when, it's the kind of conditionality that starts to happen once you're awakened. It's like there's a sort of momentum to awakening. There's certain forms of unfolding of your being that are going to take place once you've had an awakening experience, that are going to bring you in the direction of full awakening, full enlightenment.
Thank you. That's a wonderful explication. We almost had an accident.
I had too much coffee.
One of the things that always strikes me is it says a lot about who we are as a culture when we look at the parts of the canon, and because this is New York Insight, I'm assuming a lot of you are Pali Canon Buddhists or Vipassana practitioners and so forth. And when we look at the suttas that we emphasize, it says something really about who we are, because after all, everyone reads things selectively, and they're going to pick the things that resonate with them most. So I'm sure all of you, or most of you who are practitioners, have heard of the Kalama Sutta. And how many times do we hear that quoted, and why? And do we really understand it fully, and have we read the entire sutta? You often hear people say, the Buddha said, don't believe something just because I said it, or just because somebody you admire said it. Rely on yourself to determine what is true. Well, to some extent that's true, but if you read the entire sutta, they talk about relying on the wise. And it is not meant, or if you read it in context, it's not, well, do what you think, whatever you think is right. That doesn't sound right, forget it. But why don't you say something about that? Because that's one sutta that you hear again and again, along with be a lamp unto yourself, or, as Andrew Olensky translates it, be an island unto yourself. Dīpa means both lamp and island, and you can look at it in different ways. But these two things really affirm our individualistic bent, and particularly as Americans, or certainly Western Europeans to some extent too, we're rugged individualists. And what better to affirm our individualism than that? And
we're back to the effect of the romantic movement
on
Buddhism and the transcendentalists.
Right. And so, you know, Helen Twerkov, the founder of Tricycle, who remains a good friend of mine, used to always say, and I don't remember who told her this, everybody loves the Buddha, everybody loves the Dharma, and nobody likes the Sangha because that's where the really hard work is. I just want to sit and be away from everybody. I want to read the Dharma, but then when I have to work with people in the Sangha, I get pretty annoyed. I have to deal with all different kinds of people and all sorts of, you know, so you see the effort we have to make in this country to bring people together and to bring people from different backgrounds together because we don't do it naturally. So why would that be such an effort? And why are we instead saying, oh, the Kalama Sutta, I don't believe it because it doesn't sound right, or be a lamp unto yourself. Well, I'll just lead myself. You know, and so the Sangha is really tough for us, I think.
Yeah.
I may be wrong, you may disagree, but why don't you say something about the Kalama Sutta and how it's often misunderstood?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about the fact that people tend to ignore the bit about the wise, the testimony of the wise. But one of the very common misquotations that you get of the Kalama Sutta is actually an alteration of what the Kalama Sutta says, which is essentially saying a whole bunch of things that you shouldn't rely on, which is that things just seem to make sense, or because they've been traditionally believed, or your teacher says them, etc. So we shouldn't rely on all of those things, which doesn't mean that those things are necessarily invalid. I think it just means that those things aren't sufficient in themselves for you to take a teaching as being true. And the two criteria that the Buddha gives is, you know, when you put these teachings into practice, do they lead to the eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, or do they give rise to those things? And we should rely on the testimony of the wise as well, which brings up the question of who are the wise, and how do we know who they are?
Well, identifying them can be difficult, and you can be misled, and
yeah.
We've seen the results of that. But that is where there's a certain self-reliance. And I would say, in this way, our tradition serves us well. There's a difference between surrender and submission.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
We might surrender to the Dharma. We might surrender to the teachings. We might surrender to the way we think things are. We might realize that we've overemphasized or overestimated our own agency. And we may surrender to how things are in a way, I guess Tara Brach always talks about acceptance. And when we do that, we haven't submitted so much to a teacher as we've surrendered to Dharma, and we are willing to listen to what they say without giving up our critical faculty.
Yeah. How do we get past our cognitive biases, and how do we get past our aversions to things that might challenge us and change us? I mean, that's I think where Sangha
Yeah, I think
in.
You pointed out earlier, because we read the teachings and we reflect upon them, it's sometimes in practice where we think, ah, that's what that sutta means.
I didn't quite finish a thought earlier. So the Kalama Sutta says those two things, you know, you need to put things into practice, or perhaps, you know, see other people putting them into practice and find out whether they work or not, and trust the testimony of the wise. Once you've figured out who the wise are, and presumably that's a matter of experience, you know, who consistently seems to be saying the right things. You know, they say, well, if you do that, that's not going to work, and you do it anyway, and then you find out it didn't work, and then you start to, you know, trust that person. But one of the versions of, or misinterpretations of the Kalama Sutta is that it's saying that you should trust your common sense. There's actually several versions of this around that saying, don't trust teachings, don't trust the teachers, go with, you know, with things that fit with your common sense. But the problem with that is, who here believes anything that doesn't, you know, fit with your common sense? I mean, most of us don't. I mean, you reject views already if they don't fit with your common sense. So saying don't believe anything unless it fits with your common sense is basically just saying keep believing what you believe. it's not actually challenging you in any way whatsoever.
I think there are plenty of things, on the other hand, that I believe because they make me comfortable to believe them.
You know?
I mean, it's called denial. So, you know, the teachings often break through that. I mean, I think in practice often, and particularly with teachers who are astute, they very kind of frankly point out where you keep attaching yourself to a thought that in fact is just a self-serving and often selfish thought.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's not just that it accords with my common sense, it's that it serves me.
Yeah. There's some great teachings in the Pali Canon about friendship and about Sangha. I mean, there's the very famous one where Ananda, who was the Buddha's companion, well, assistant, I suppose, for many years, and also his cousin as well, he just had this realization one day, and he said to the Buddha, "Lord, you know, just realize something. You know, spiritual friendship is half of the spiritual life. You know, really important." And the Buddha says, "No, don't say that, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life," which is quite a strong statement. There's another sutta which explains that a bit more. Is that, before Ananda, there were a number of other attendants, some of whom didn't really work out. I think one of the Buddha's attendants actually just wandered off and left him one day. And there was one particular attendant, I think he was called Meghiya, who was with the Buddha. And the two of them were on their own somewhere, and they'd been out and done their alms round. And Meghiya, when he'd been doing his alms round, collecting his food for the day, had spotted this mango grove, which looked really nice. It was a really beautiful looking mango grove. And he was filled with this kind of spiritual craving to go and be in this mango grove. And he had this idea he was going to have really fantastic meditations. You know, it was like the best place to you could possibly meditate. And he asked the Buddha if he could go off and meditate there. And the Buddha said, "No, please don't, because then I'll be on my own. And there's some other people coming along soon. And why don't you just wait till they arrive, and then you could go off." And Meghiya asked three times, which is a kind of a triggering mechanism for the Buddha, because whenever you ask the Buddha something three times, he always gives you an answer one way or another quite definitively. And Meghiya had really done his sales pitch very well. He said, "Well, this is going to be good for my spiritual practice." And the Buddha makes what sounds like a slightly sarcastic comment, which is, "Well, if you're saying it's for your spiritual practice, Meghiya, then how can I possibly stand in your way?" And then Meghiya goes off and has this terrible meditation, comes back and tells the Buddha about it. And then the Buddha gives him this teaching on spiritual friendship and the value of spiritual friendship. And he basically takes the entire Eightfold Path and expounds it in terms of spiritual friendship, about how you need friends in order to help you be ethical. For example, you need friends in order to help you realize what is right speech. You need friends in order to help you with your meditation practice. Very valuable. Meghiya is like the perfect example of someone who wanted to go it alone.
Right. I think and also spiritual friendship in that kind of like dharma relationship, if with your dharma friends, they will say things to you that other friends would never say. Mm. So they would say, for instance, "You've been talking a lot about this person. What is the issue?" rather than join you in wrong speech. And that's not always easy. Mm. But a true spiritual friend will point that out to you and kindly and at the right time and in a timely way. But anyway, I think I want to read another one of these quotes because I have a lot of fun with these quotes because the great thing about Bodhipaksha is that nobody's really being criticized. It's not like gotcha. You said
I
something.
I have to work at that.
Well, that's true. Some of them we've edited down a little bit. Some of my favorite people have said the wrong things, and I. But
he's joking now.
let me see. Are you guys bored with these, or since everything is a reflection of our minds, everything can be changed by our minds? That sounds, again, like the beginning of the Dhammapada, a misunderstanding of the opening lines of the Dhammapada.
Yeah, it's very much along those lines. And again, it's very, you know, I can't remember what the origins are. Maybe you could have a quick read of it.
My eyes aren't that good, but...
Yeah. It sounds very Hindu.
Yeah.
The Buddha
law of attraction, you call it law of attraction-esque. I have to admit, I hear about the law of attraction, I have no idea what it is.
It's basically this idea that you create your own reality. So if you do the positive thinking,
That's interesting because, you know, we have a rather restrictive ad policy, and once this group that considered itself Buddhist and they were publishing these books on affirmations talked about curing breast cancer with affirmations. And so we refused to run the ad because it really puts the onus on the person suffering. And that goes to the last one. Again, it's like the idea of everything is karma.
If you persuade somebody not to go through, you know, the medical channels with, surgery and medication because they think that they can cure their breast cancer through...
Right. I mean, but
that's really dangerous.
We didn't publish the ad, of course.
Well,
I turned it down.
I'm just horrified by the idea.
Right. I mean, I was a little bit horrified, too. That was several years ago, but it was pretty clear to us that they imagined that that was a Buddhist idea. Mm-hmm. In other words, everyone gets old, everyone gets sick, and everybody dies. Are affirmations going to change that? I mean, that was a very strange notion. Mm-hmm. And it likewise dovetails with every human being is the author of his or his own health or disease. Mm-hmm. It's the same silliness. But anyway, the reasons...
And it is true to a certain extent. I mean,
To a certain extent, because you'll get sick and die anyway.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, sometimes stress makes us sick, or sometimes we don't take care of ourselves properly. Which reminds me, you said something earlier about people feel, often you hear people say they feel self-loathing or self-hate. That's a very common affliction. And yet, they're taking care of themselves at the same time. It's an interesting...
Yeah, this is something I actually just wrote an article about this quite recently. We were talking, actually, about a quote which Sharpton Salzberg very often uses, which is along the lines, again, of if you really loved yourself, then you wouldn't ever do anything to harm another person, which is a great thing to do, except that she says that the Buddha said it. And the particular scriptural passage that she's referring to actually says something that's the reverse of that, which is that you should learn to take care of other people the way that you take care of yourself. I was saying to James, it's a bit like paraphrasing Jesus's injunction to love our neighbor as thyself, and saying, well, you should love yourself as you love your neighbor. It's a very different thing, and it's not that either of those things is wrong. I mean, we certainly do need to learn to take care of ourselves. But there's a really interesting teaching where the Buddha is in a conversation with one of his king disciples, one of his royal disciples, and he commented on how people say that they don't like themselves, but if you look at what they actually do, they show every sign of liking themselves. They're taking care of themselves. And he didn't go into this in depth, but look at our lives. You cross the road, you make sure that you don't get hit by a car. When you're eating food, you don't pick things deliberately that you don't like. You always make sure that you've got all your favorite foods in the house as much as you possibly can. You treat yourself to entertainment. You buy yourself, a widescreen television set just because you want it. And you say you hate yourself. Well, if that's how you treat somebody that you hate, please hate me, as much as you want. And I think the problem is that we are taking care of ourselves and we're showing ourselves kindness all the time, but we're not appreciating it. We focus on the parts of our psyches which are self-critical, and we identify with that and we say, well, I'm a self-critical person. I'm a person who doesn't like myself. But we don't notice and therefore don't identify with the many, many other things that we're doing where we're actually taking care of ourselves. So I think that a lot of our problem with not liking ourselves isn't so much that we don't like ourselves, although that definitely happens, but it's that we're just not appreciating the fact that we're doing so many positive things for ourselves all the time. Very different, very interesting experience, for example, just to sit down with a meal that you've chosen because you like it and say, this is me taking care of myself. This is me being kind to myself. And just really appreciate that.
That's very wonderfully put. You know, of course, there are people who do not take care of themselves. They say they suffer from depression and they engage in self-destructive habits or don't engage in self-care at all. And I think we were talking about this earlier. Certain practices are recommended for different people at different times in their lives. And depending on what they're experiencing, some practices may be harmful and others may be helpful. And particularly if a person is feeling a lot of self-loathing and having difficulty even bothering to take care of themselves, contemplating the repulsiveness of the body may not be the best thing for them to be doing.
And traditionally that wouldn't have been recommended.
Exactly.
Buddhism recognized that people are of different psychological types. Some people are more driven by craving and desire for pleasure, and some people are more driven by ill will. And someone who has a lot of ill will would not have been recommended to do practices like observing the decomposition of the corpse or reflecting on the loathsomeness of the body, because they've already got enough of that going on. Thank you very much. They would have been advised to do practices like loving kindness and mudita practice, joyful appreciation, and reflections on beauty, for example. So these things were very specifically tailored to people's spiritual needs.
You know, I was on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein and Analeo. It was a 2-week retreat, and Analeo taught the first half, and Joseph, whom I've known for years and I've sat with for years, taught the second half. I'm more used to his teaching style, and I know more about his teachers. But Analeo is a very well-educated monk and knows the tradition very well.
A real scholar.
Yeah, he's written plenty about the Satipatthana Sutta and has more or less helped us understand what parts were there originally or first and which came later. But he was very insistent upon contemplation of the body, contemplation of, in all of its gore. And the reaction among, wrote an editorial about it, the reaction among the retreatants was often very, people were very resistant. In fact, many of them were very angry. And some of them raised their hand and said, what about the Greek ideal of beauty and so forth? And he said, I have nothing wrong with the Greek ideal of beauty, but it doesn't seem to appear in the Pali Canon. And so the resistance was certainly understandable. And I certainly felt it myself as somebody who grew up in the West and has certain attitudes and already was, and whether we're Protestants or not, we grew up in a rather Protestant culture that had certain ideas about the body that probably lead one to feel resistant to this practice. In my particular case, I thought, I'm just going to try it. Let's see what happens. I'm not feeling particularly vulnerable or anything. And it was a very powerful practice, but certainly a very good friend of mine who was sitting next to me said, I'll never do this. And I completely understand her. But there's a misunderstanding about what that practice is, I think. It's supposed to be a skillful means. It's supposed to break attachment, our attachment to this body. And so as we age, as we fall apart, we understand, that's what happens. And that's its nature. But the morbidity that seems to come with it is really, I think, a misunderstanding. I don't know.
There's also resistance to things like loving kindness practice as well.
And people, I had that.
Yeah, lots of people have that. I hear so many people saying that they resist it. And they're usually the people that need to do it. And they're resisting it because it challenges them. And I think this is where the testimony of the wise comes in as well. And you need to be listening to people who have a wiser perspective than you have.
No, I can tell a story that I'll embarrass myself a little bit, but I was very, very, very angry with someone. And every year, Sharon says, are you coming to the Metta retreat? Sharon Salzberg. And I say, you know, I don't have time. The reality is that Metta kind of gave me the creeps. It just really annoyed me, and I thought it's so sentimental. And like, you know, if the rabbit is happy, the hawk is hungry. You know, if the hawk is happy, the rabbit's dead. You know, and so this whole idea of inclusivity and our wishing all beings well was something I simply resisted. It did not go with my personality. And one day, I was so angry with this person, I had this dream in which the person was hit by a car, and I thought, I'm sick, you know? And so I wrote to Sharon, and I said, I had a dream, he got hit by a car, and she didn't answer me. She just sent me back the dates of her Metta retreat. And this was in February, and I went, and actually, it was very powerful, and I'm already signed up for the next one. But that's an instance in which a person wiser than myself, whether she misquoted the Buddha or not, you know, actually pushed me, and she kind of embarrassed me. She just didn't even answer. She sent me the date. And she was, you know, it was a very kind thing to do. The other thing about Sharon's misquote is I asked her about it, you know, because it appeared in the magazine. Oh, yeah, I said, Sharon, by the way, you misquoted the Buddha, and you're going to end up in tricycle as having done such. And her response was interesting, because I think it was Goenkaji who told her that, which would make sense. It might have been Manindra.
It might have been Manindra.
And the feeling is that, you know, the teacher does in some ways become the embodiment for the student of those teachings. And so, you know, you're right. It's not in the Pali Canon.
That doesn't invalidate it as a teaching.
Right. No, I understand. But it's good to know that it's not in the canon.
It's just a shame to say the Buddha said something if
he didn't say it.
If he ever said it. Well, he may have said it. We don't know.
It's not recorded
as having been said by him.
You know, there's an interesting book coming out, in case it should be out in November. I interviewed Stephen Batchelor for the next issue of Tricycle. And he has a very strong sense of what he thinks the Buddha's original intent was and what is actually, he has a whole methodology for teasing out what he thinks the Buddha actually said and dismissing those things he felt he did not. Now, there's a historical problem here, because the Buddha lived a long, long, long time ago, and people weren't writing things down. And Elaine Pagels refers to something that in an interview from Tricycle in 2005 as creative misinterpretation. Cultures tend to interpret teachings or traditions in a way that makes sense to them, and in a way that helps them to face the challenges of the time they're living in. And it's not till maybe centuries later that somebody notices, hey, we misunderstood something, but by then the tradition has flowered. It's not wrong. It's these things, the tradition is living and it evolves. There was a certain point in China when they began to say, wait a second, that's not Buddhism, that's Taoism, or that's Confucianism. And they began to try then to tease out what it was that the Buddha actually taught. So what the Buddha actually taught, though, is a little problematic. There tend to be two schools, those who think the historical Buddha can be understood to some extent through the historical method, and those like me who think we don't know. I don't know, which side do you fall on?
We don't know. We've got the texts, but the problem is that the texts, I don't think, very closely align with what the Buddha said or how he said it. When you talked about creative misinterpretation, I think there was probably a process of uncreative misinterpretation which went on for a couple of hundred years. The texts are so stereotyped, they are so repetitive, that I don't think the Buddha taught like that at all. A friend of mine, Will Buckingham, who's a novelist, has this concept of the dull monk in the third row. So he sets the scene, he imagines that the Buddha is talking and you know, he's teaching, and there's always, you know, nuances, and there's humor and irony in his teaching, and there's a lot of people just sitting there kind of, you know, completely wrapped in this and just, you know, drinking it all in. And at the end of it, you can kind of remember the spirit of what the Buddha said. It's like when you've heard a really good talk, or you've been to see a really good comedian or something like that. Oh, that was so funny. And he tried to think what any of the jokes were. He can't actually remember. But he imagines this rather dull, studious monk with no imagination in the third row, who's basically taking a set of bullet points of what the Buddha said. And this becomes the, you know, like the distillation, a very kind of dry, kind of plodding distillation. And I, at the same time, Will mentioned this, I was teaching high school students at a university. I was on this program to help students from impoverished backgrounds to prepare for college. And I was doing quite a lot of teaching and looking at my students' notes. It's really amazing how badly we take notes, how badly people take notes. There are these distortions, the connections between things get lost. Something that's originally outlined as this kind of dynamic thing, you know, this led to this and this led to this, ends up being this static point, static bullet points, which basically, you know, lose all of the vitality of the original.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Stephen is on my mind, Stephen Batchelor, because I just spoke with him and I just interviewed him and we just put something together. And he has a new book out called After Buddhism. A lot of people thought he should call it Before Buddhism, which also made sense. But one of the things I asked him, I mean, you're humanizing the Buddha, and he is humanizing the Buddha. But then he also said part of him required that the Buddha be more than a human being. And I think there is a need for this ideal to look to. And, you know, we don't say that the Buddha is a god, although in some traditions he becomes very godlike. Certainly in Theravada tradition, less so. But we do have the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and we do have an ideal. And it also kind of supports our tendency to want a single person to have generated this great wisdom, and more often than not, I think, an entire culture produces such wisdom over time. And I think, you know, in the West, we have, say, Walter Scott on the one hand, who lionized a single person and considered that person more or less a prime mover. And you have Tolstoy, who has this more oceanic sense of history, where an entire culture is moving forward, and the thrust of it isn't the will of a single individual. And I think we hold both in the tradition. We have this Buddha who is an ideal, and we have to understand that entire cultures have built these teachings. And I think in a highly individualistic culture, we would like to think that the Buddha snapped his fingers and this sort of teaching emerged. But that he lived in a culture and there was a context. And I think that it would be like saying that Jesus, you know, spontaneously came up with all of these teachings. Of course, if you say he's God, that makes sense. And if you believe that, it makes sense. If you think of him as an individual living in the Galilee in the first century, you understand him very differently. And you understand that an entire culture advanced his teachings. Which may not even resemble the original. But it's an interesting idea anyway. I mean, I'm not saying I know the answer, but you know, we love and venerate the Buddha, but...
Well, one of the things related to this that I've noticed is that it's actually sometimes quite difficult to see what the suttas say, because when you talk about Buddhism, especially when you talk about Theravadan Buddhism, what you're talking about really is Buddhaghosa and the train of teachings that right. follow from him. And so most Theravadan teaching is what I call, you know, warmed over Buddhaghosa. There are whole books of Theravadan teachings which are basically just, you know, paraphrasing, you know, what Buddhaghosa said. But sometimes what Buddhaghosa says is radically different from what's in the suttas, and it can be quite difficult to see that. For example, Jhana is a very important teaching. It's found, you know, all over the Pali Canon, and virtually every teacher who talks about Jhana, myself included, for many years, would say, well, in first jhana there's five jhana factors, And then you look at the suttas and you see, well, actually, there's only four jhana factors. That should be interesting.
It's the Visuddhimagga that's essentially...
It's the Visuddhimagga, yeah.
Yeah, but in another way, though, I mean, I've heard plenty of scholars or plenty of teachers who aren't particularly fond of the Visuddhimagga. You know, they say, well, this isn't in the suttas, this is the Visuddhimagga. But does it matter, really? I mean, people have propensities, and why is the Visuddhimagga somehow less valid as a teaching? Or why is the conceit of an original teaching in any way, is it privileged in any way?
Well, and I think it's misleading. If you're trying to, I mean, Buddhism is a series of practices. Mm-hmm. Jhana is something that we're meant to experience. If you don't have a clear idea of what jhana actually is, and I don't think Buddhaghosa had a clear idea of what jhana actually mm-hmm. was, then I think it's actually misleading. He had the view that only one person in a million could experience jhana.
Right.
Now, if you look at the Pali Canon, everyone was experiencing jhana. You know, it was happening right. all over the place. It wasn't one in a million. It was virtually anybody who was prepared to set up a regular meditation practice was going to experience jhana.
Right. You know, I tend to lean toward the Pali Canon as opposed to the Visuddhimagga. I mean,
If it's a choice between them,
that's where I go.
Yeah.
Except that the Pali Canon itself is the product of centuries of learning and interpretation.
It is, and you know, but what I'm suggesting is we need to something, you know, peel back to see what the Pali Canon actually says. Another example I'm assuming that people aren't leaving because we're boring you. I know one person said they had to leave early. So there are the jhanas. If you look at the suttas, there are four jhanas. There are also four states which are never called jhanas, called formless spheres. They're never once in the Pali Canon called jhanas. Mm-hmm. If you look at almost any post-Buddhaghosa, post-Visuddhimagga text on jhanas, it'll say there are eight jhanas, that you go through the four jhanas and then you go through these formless spheres, which are often labeled as being jhanas, jhanas 5, 6, 7, and 8. The thing is that these formless spheres can be accessed without going through jhana, first of all. And this is very confusing for some practitioners when they experience them because they don't know what it is that they're experiencing. They're thinking, well, I didn't go through, you know, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, and then have this experience of the boundaries between my sense of self and the world dissolving away. And so you end up...
Well, the jhanas are making a comeback, and if you...
They are. yeah.
You know, but you know, Dalila, I don't know if it's time, but maybe we could take some questions. Maybe you guys are thinking of things that you'd like to ask about, or if you have any questions about the magazine, how we make decisions and why we would do such a thing as point out what the Buddha never said. Or if you have questions for Bodhipaksha, who's certainly more learned than I am, we'd welcome those questions.
One moment.
Dalila has a...
Is it on? Yeah. Hello? I'm just wondering...
Yes, it doesn't seem to be working, Dalila. Oh, she's flicking a switch over there.
Okay. I'm just wondering if you could address the notion of empty of self and what you think the Buddha actually said and meant and what and how it's been distorted.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting one, because there are quite a few suttas about shunyata, right? Sunyata in Pali, and it's very explicitly stated that things are empty of a self. I think it's a perfectly, you know, it's obviously a very valid teaching. It's not one that's emphasized very strongly in the Theravadan tradition, and this is one of the things that I find very interesting about the Mahayana. A lot of people make the assumption that because I keep going to the Pali Canon to try to clarify whether the Buddha said something or not, that I must be anti-Mahayana, because their scriptures, despite what the scriptures themselves say and, you know, followers of the Mahayana might say, weren't actually taught by the historical Buddha. But to me, that doesn't invalidate them at all. It's quite obvious to me that although the tradition that evolved into the Theravada
preserved in a way the kind of fossil remnants of this teaching on shunyata, but didn't really seem to know what to do with it. It seems that some other practitioners who evolved into the Mahayana had this as a kind of a central focus in their practice. And I think it's just a deeper level of looking at non-self. So, you know, for example, you know, the Buddha certainly taught, he didn't teach that we had no self. The Buddha taught that there was nothing that we can define ourselves by. There's nothing that we can look at and say, well, yeah, this is myself. So you can do that with feelings, for example. You can look at your feelings and say, well, my feelings are not myself. How can you establish that your feelings are not yourself? Well, you can watch them coming and going. You can watch a particular feeling coming into being and passing away. But you can look even more deeply into a feeling. When you start having a feeling, say, of anxiety, and you look really closely at that moment by moment by moment by moment, it kind of dissolves away. It's like getting really close to a cinema screen, and what seemed to be somebody's face is now just this, you know, collection of twinkling pixels, and your experience of your body, your experience of your feelings can get like that as well. And you recognize that there is no essence to a feeling, which is a kind of, it's a deeper application of the same principle of non-self. Just, you know, looking at things in more fine-grained detail. So yeah, it's a great teaching, very, very valuable, and anyway, I'm pro shunyata.
You know, I've heard that one particular Pali scholar discuss, sunyata and, say, interconnectedness as something that the Mahayana externalizes far more than the Theravada does. Mm-hmm. Rather, for the Theravadin, it might be more descriptive, sunya rather than sunyata, and that it describes our internal process of perception more accurately than it is applied to the phenomenal world. That's just not something that I have considered fully, but it's a difference really in the way Mahayana and Theravada approach that particular idea.
Yeah, the Buddha didn't seem that interested in the phenomenal world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when the Buddha talked about things being impermanent, yes, the world is impermanent, mountains are impermanent, he referred to those things, but when he's talking about things being impermanent, he's really saying anything you experience is impermanent. No experience that you can have, there's no experience that you can have which is going to be, you know, unchanging.
Right.
So even if scientists were to prove that there was something in the universe that didn't change, it wouldn't invalidate the Buddha's teaching at all, because your experience of that thing would be changing all the time, because your mind is not stable. It's this, you know, endless series of moments of perception, no two of which are the same. So it doesn't really matter whether things in the external world are permanent or impermanent, although as it happens, they're all impermanent. It wasn't really what the Buddha was talking about.
Yes.
I was struck at one point that you referred to when you're really talking about what is true and or real about what Buddha said, you likened interpretations to the disconnection of disabled students and
No, they were not disabled students.
Or not disabled, but I mean disadvantaged.
They were just ordinary students.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think when we speak at all about Buddhist teaching, as you pointed out, there are no real originals. They were all written down much later. But, you know, in cultures that are totally verbal, and anthropologists that have studied these cultures, the people that carry the tradition, the verbal traditions are taught to remember them with great precision.
Yes.
And the people probably who were the first to write these received those teachings probably in a very accurate form.
I agree.
And I think that's very important when from some, you know, to when listening to your teachings, you begin to think, well, nobody knows anything.
Yeah, but it, when you look at the Pali Canon, it has all the hallmarks of something which was designed to be passed on in a in an oral way. It's got all the repetition. So it wasn't that the Buddha gave a talk, I think, at least this is what I assume, that the Buddha didn't give a talk and people remembered exactly what the Buddha said. I think it's more like they said, okay, here are the key points of what the Buddha said, and then let's turn this into a kind of a mnemonic form that we can then pass on to future generations.
You know, I think you're not giving quite as much credit to the passage of exact words as most verbal. Forgive me for disagreeing with you. You're much infinitely more learned than I am, but I have been so impressed.
I'm not a scholar.
I've been so impressed by this passing down of verbal traditions with exactitude, that I think for all of us, the idea that we have direct contact to the Buddha's word is important, and that it's not just, you know, the gist of it.
Yeah, I'd just like to clarify that actually, you know, I value the scriptures very highly. They are the closest we're going to get to what the Buddha actually said. And for that reason, I think it's important to study them, you know, very, very closely. In terms of the you know, mind-numbingly repetitious nature of much of the Pali Canon, I really can't believe that the Buddha taught in that way. I mean, maybe that's just a failure of belief doesn't prove anything. There are some parts of the Pali Canon which are really vital and alive and have a very, very different tone to them. If you look at the Sutta Nipata, for example, which is a fairly short collection of suttas, and it's generally reckoned to be one of the oldest parts of the Pali Canon because it's in very archaic Pali, compared to the middle-length sayings, the longer sayings, etc. What you see is really kind of beautifully articulated, flowing, almost poetry. It's alive. There are these this beautiful sense.
Which set are these?
The Sutta Nipata.
Nipata.
Nipata. Nipata. There's a very old translation by, spaced out on his name. It'll come to me, but I'm not remembering it right now. But you kind of see something there that's really alive and vital, and it's like, you know, the Buddha is talking with these people, and there's this sense of, you know, intimacy and warmth, and you just don't get that in most of the other Buddhist scriptures. So, you know, once you've had a kind of a glimpse of the Buddha teaching in that particular way, it's hard to believe that these other more repetitive teachings are anything more than a kind of a distillation of points that he made, but framed in a way to make them easier to pass on to future generations. But I can't prove anything. What I really want to do is get enlightened. Because get enlightened. A lot of people have a particular way of looking at their spiritual quest. My spiritual quest is to know the mind of the Buddha, which does not mean to have some kind of mystical knowledge of what his thoughts were. because that's not possible, but to follow through in his teachings with as much intelligence as I possibly can in order to experience the remarkably, radically different way that he saw the world. I mean, he saw himself and he saw the world in a way completely different to the way that we saw it. And that's what I want to get to in my practice.
I guess that's what I was addressing in my, you know, in my sense.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I have a question for you then. You know, we watch the history of traditions and their doctrinal disputes and whole tracts of a scripture can be removed and buried and disappear and later found and so forth. So it's unusual for human beings over time not to have disagreements and to shape the teachings in a way that suits them. So I'm not saying that is true or not true. A lot of people have a lot vested in believing that this is an accurate reflection of what one particular man in history said. And there are a lot of very good scholars who think it is a good reflection of those original teachings. But the question I have is that the teachings are the teachings, whether we can determine that this one particular person called Gautama actually taught them in the way they've come down to us. Why is that important to one? And sometimes it's important to me, and I don't have a perfect answer, but they're the teachings, and we put them into practice, and we discover that they work, and that we discover our lives become transformed, and then we understand there's this possibility of liberation. But that it comes from a particular person at a particular time, why is that important to us? I asked a few people this question because I was interested. And I know by no means diminish the importance that we attach to that, but how do you feel about that, Bodhipaksha?
I'm not sure I can answer the question. Why is it important? I kind of almost have to come at it from a number of different ways. Because, I mean, I've talked about, for example, how I think the commentarial tradition can make it difficult to see what the Buddha actually taught.
Right.
I mean, the Buddha was teaching a method. He was teaching practices. And if we don't understand what those practices were, then we're maybe not going to end up, you know, recapitulating the journey that he made.
Mm-hmm.
If we have fundamental misunderstandings, for example, thinking that everything is a unity, that it's all one, then we might stop in our practice when we have an experience which feels like, you know, an experience of oneness. And we might think, well, you know, I'm here, I've made it. But actually you're just experiencing, you know, a formless sphere of the kind that he himself experienced before he gave up the various groups that he was a part of and went off on his own. So I think we can be misled.
Mm-hmm. We can be misled, but why do you imagine we find it so important to say that these are the actual teachings of the Buddha, as opposed to a set of skillful means to achieve liberation?
Well, skillful means to achieve what, though?
We're saying it's in the canon. I mean, let's say different Buddhist literatures describe nirvana differently. Whichever one you tend to follow is one that you find very important. Why is it important that it's what the Buddha actually taught, if it's a set of teachings? And I like your emphasis on practice as opposed to, you know, orthodoxy.
Yeah.
It's something that we actually practice. Yeah. But why is it important that we attach it to a particular man in history?
Well, it's his realization that we're trying to recapture. I mean, he was the one who started it all. He had a particular experience of awakening. And the whole of the Dharma is about trying to have that experience of awakening. So it's not that it's literally necessary to, you know, to tie the teachings back to that particular, you know, person, because if other practitioners following the Buddha, you know, had insights, ways of teaching which were slightly different from the Buddha's but lead to the same state of awakening, then that's absolutely fine. But
No, go ahead.
No, but I don't know where I was going, actually.
Well, it's kind of like the argument about whether or not Shakespeare actually wrote Shakespeare's plays. Does it matter? They're still his plays.
Yeah.
Those plays are still those plays. Yeah. I'm just wondering why, for instance, it's important to me to venerate the Buddha. I do, and I think these teachings came down to me from the Buddha. but I understand historically or maybe scientifically that can be very easily challenged. But why is it important to me? And I can't answer the question except that this image of a person embodies an ideal, and the possibility of what he achieved is taught to us to be very real. And the fact that somebody achieved this seems to be important. Anyway, it's not a question I've answered. I just often ask the question, why are we attached to that notion?
I'll reflect on that.
Nobody's been able to answer it very well. I can't, certainly. But why is that important? I mean, there's this set of practices that we do that change our lives. But I just think we need some ideal to look to. But anyway. Go ahead.
Anyway, it's wonderful to hear the dialogue. Thank you. You were just also talking about, because to me, Buddhism was only practiced by the Buddha, and the rest of it is the kind of, because of the software that we have, our brains and our conditioning, we all interpret it with culturally conditioned, we spoke about, with whether we do it through brain science or quantum physics or through Christianity or Judaism or what we know. So my question is, it seems like then, how we, us, reading the suttas and studying them, I mean, you know, we do have all the teachings also. I don't know if you said it, but I remember what Andrew Lansky said, as long as the principles that I teach are very clear and correct, I don't care what form they come in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he said something similar to that, or am I quoting him wrong, paraphrasing him?
I don't know.
But, so anyway, maybe I'm paraphrasing it wrong, but it seems like, as you were saying, our aim is awakening, and so to me, it seems like, how then do I kind of take the teachings and kind of use that as a vehicle for liberation, whether it is tantric, Vajrayana, Mahayana, and you know, all the Theravada tradition, which I've kind of explored them all in a way, and began to, because they all seem to be pointing the same direction, really, in some ways. And I'm somehow, I mean, I'm kind of in this kind of, I guess some of us, or many of us, are in this kind of confused, because there's so much out there.
Yeah.
And how do I kind of trust, find the trust? And to me, it seems like this body here itself doesn't lie in terms of its sensations, feelings that is here. It never seemed to be incorrect or lies. The body is always present. And I remember, I don't know if I'm correct, but the Satipatthana, in some ways, 65% of it is really all about the body, isn't it? Kind of, I don't know. It's all about the body standing, sitting, eating, or whatever we do, activities. And so I'm just at this point kind of, and I think I maybe dabbled into too many things, but I want to be rooted in one tradition. So I'm hanging on to the Pali Canon, but not, after 6 years, I'm kind of taking a step back. And for 6 years, I really studied the canon. I studied a couple of years with Andrew Lansky. I had studied with an abbot for about 5 years in the very Theravada tradition, maybe more in the Buddhaghosa, but all different traditions. And now I'm kind of exploring more the tantric kind of Vajrayana practices a bit. There seem to, no one method seem to, or no one tradition seem to be able to hold it all, it seems. Anyway, I'm just at this point a little bit, I know what I'm referring to, that we need all the methods. We can't exclude any one of them.
Yeah.
But yet, I kind of trying to find some sort of guidance that will get me to awakening. So I don't know. I mean, I know I'm rambling a bit, but but how can you trust this brain that is so conditioned and so culturally conditioned historically? And it's got a lot of faulty, as we know, the brain really lies. I mean, it does. We cannot rely on neuroscience is telling us that the brain does what it wants to do. It's all unconscious processes that's going on.
I don't know. Joseph Goldstein wrote, you know, his book One Dharma. And it was a long time since I've read it, but I think he was saying that, you know, in a way you need to, like, you know, commit yourself quite deeply to one particular form of practice. But then you can get to the point where there's like a, you know, crossover effect. You're exploring, you know, other ways of practicing the Dharma as well. But I think you need to commit yourself to a particular path. And, you know, there can be cross-fertilization from other ways of looking at things. I mean, I do take inspiration from the Mahayana Sutras in particular, and the, you know, the Mahayana teachings more generally, especially teachings on Shunyata, which I think supplies something which is missing in the Pali Canon, not entirely missing, but it's so sketchy, it's not particularly useful. So anyway, I don't know. At the same time, it's very interesting. One thing I find, I practice in the Trivratna tradition, which recognizes that there's value in all of the different historical expressions. The Trivratna tradition that I practice in recognizes the value in the various Trivratna. So, you know, there's the Pali text and the Theravada that is based on those texts. There's the Mahayana and there's the Tantra, and there's you know, beautiful teachings and very, very useful teachings in all of those. And so for quite a long time I studied the Pali text, and I also studied Mahayana texts like Shantideva, in particular Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara. And then for a few years I just kind of concentrated on the Pali canon, and then with some friends we decided to study Shantideva again. It was for the first time in maybe 6 or 7 years, maybe 10 years since I'd last picked up Shantideva. And when I started reading some of this, I was thinking, I'm not even sure this is Buddhism, some of this. He seems to have such a strong aversion to the body. It seems to go beyond what the Buddha was pointing to. So yeah, sometimes it's a little bit kind of funny if your sense of what Buddhism is becomes conditioned by what you're used to hearing Buddhism is. And I don't know what to make of that.
You know, one of the things that you said that I found very interesting, you said, I think, to paraphrase you, I suppose that they're all moving toward the same goal. Obviously, not everyone thinks that's so. Not everyone believes that all of these traditions, or all of these different Buddhist traditions, have the same understanding of what liberation is. I couldn't say. I would say what Joseph says, would say. I would say, who knows? But in a pluralistic society, naturally you're going to be exposed to different traditions and pulled in different directions. But like Bodhipaksha says, I listened to teachers' advice who told me, focus and pursue a particular tradition, because after all, it's my tendency to say, oh, this is getting boring, why don't I go sit at a Dzogchen retreat, rather than see it through, what it is I'm doing, and see what the other side of it is. On the other hand, taking practices from other traditions may serve as useful antidotes to when we get stuck in a particular state. And again, I'll tell you what Joseph said to me recently about Dzogchen. And there's an interesting discussion between him and Sam Harris on Sam Harris's site about this sort of thing. They're talking about Dzogchen and the Theravadin path. That when you're striving in a certain way, when you're very focused and it's very linear and you're sitting every day and you find that rather oppressive sort of striving sets in. For some people, like the idea of Dzogchen, of the spaciousness or the sense I'm already there, because he also practiced with some Dzogchen masters, was a helpful antidote to that very tight, focused, linear, step-by-step kind of approach to Nibbana. You know, so, you know, as Bodhipaksha was talking to me about earlier, it's easy to start thinking of Nibbana as a place or a goal or somewhere you end up.
That's that was just the two of us that were talking about.
Yeah, this is, we were talking about this separately. And again, I'm not a teacher, but this is what I've been told. And, you know, again, the challenge of living in a pluralistic society, not only among multiple Buddhist traditions, which is something rather recent, but also the monotheistic faiths, we're always challenged, why this and not that? And my answer for that is, stick with it, because I'm following Bodhipaksha's advice here, because it's too easy to pick up and leave when things get tough. Make sense?
Yeah, completely.
Well, just related to that, and then a question, but I hope I'm not misquoting Thich Nhat Hanh, who said that AA was actually an organic Buddhism in the West as a different path. But I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the idea of nirvana or enlightenment and how it gets interpreted in the different traditions.
Yeah, what we were talking about earlier was kind of spatial metaphors, which you get that, well, there's samsara, and we think of that as being, you know, what is around us. And we talk about the path, you know, treading the path to nirvana. And so we start thinking about nirvana as being, you know, a place to get to. It becomes, you know, reified. But nirvana is the extinction of something. You know, it's the extinction of, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. It's the extinction of delusion. It's not a thing. It's an absence of something. So I think people try to get rid of the spatial metaphor, because the spatial metaphor becomes problematic. Because here we are in samsara, and how are we going to get to this, you know, mythical place of nirvana? It seems very far away. They try to collapse the spatial metaphor by saying, well, samsara and nirvana are one. But that doesn't really mean anything, because how can samsara faring on and extinction be one thing? I think it's trying to reduce things to a unity again in a way that doesn't actually work particularly well. I suppose I prefer just to think of what we're actually doing. We're either faring on in greed, hatred, and delusion, or we're extinguishing greed, hatred, and delusion.
There is, though, like in the Zen tradition, an internal logic to saying, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness form. Mm. Nirvana is samsara, samsara is nirvana. It's, again, a skillful means. It helps one not think dualistically about these things and not to confuse these things for the place that you talk about. So yeah. I think those things are actually quite poetic and liberative if they're understood in their context.
I think they can be very useful, because what it can be suggesting is that we're not trying to escape from samsara. What we're trying to do is look at it really, really closely and see how it functions so that we don't do it anymore.
You mentioned 12-step programs, or you mentioned AA, and you mentioned Thich Nhat Hanh's discussion of that. Like others, he was thoroughly impressed with this very Western solution to an otherwise intractable problem. And it's interesting, when the need arises, you know, a methodology materializes for dealing with it. Human beings are remarkably creative in approaching problems. And you had this problem of addiction, and you ended up with two very wise people, among others, who kind of addressed it in a way that gave better results than anything up until that point did. And I think what he's referring to in part is that, again, Tanasaro Bhikkhu talks about suffering. He, using something that Westerners are very familiar with,
yeah.
He refers to it as addiction.
Huh.
And so this attachment, this oppressive sort of driving attachment, in the case of AA, it's an attachment to a substance. But he sees suffering as we normally understand it. He finds an apt metaphor for that to be addiction, a repetitive behavior, and self-destructive behavior, and obsessive behavior, repetitive thinking. So it's interesting that both Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, somebody who's a Mahayanist, but also very influenced as a Vietnamese person by the Theravada and Christianity, coming at it in a similar way that Tan Jeff does. Here we are dealing with this knot of addiction once unraveled, reveals to us a whole constellation of factors that cause suffering. So
I like that better than his translation of dukkha as stress.
Well, he calls it stress too. He has all sorts of opinions that you don't get into arguments with.
I say something else about samsara and nirvana? I noticed something very curious. They're very paired in our minds. You know, almost every book on Buddhism is going to say, well, you've got samsara and nirvana. You would expect to see them paired a lot in the Pali Canon. I haven't found anywhere in the Pali Canon where samsara and nirvana are mentioned right next to each other, which I find really strange. I've got no explanation for it. And I was hoping to ask Bhikkhu Bodhi about it, because he was on the recent Western Buddhist Teachers Conference at Omega. Or no, he was meant to be on it. He was scheduled to be there, but unfortunately he was sick. And this was my big question I was dying to ask him. You know, has he actually seen these two terms together? And is there some significance in the fact that they don't seem to be found as a pair?
You can email him.
Okay, I will do that.
That's what I do when I don't know something.
Okay, I will email him.
I think you did inspire that "What the Buddha Never Said" column by him when he realized that the Buddha didn't say teach just one thing and one thing only. Mm. But
I've repeated that one myself.
I did too.
Mea culpa.
Until he wrote that piece. Yeah.
In a way, I kind of think it's true. I mean, the underlying motive that the Buddha had was to help free people from suffering. So
right.
I think everything he said, in one way or another, even if it didn't explicitly mention suffering, is helping people move in that direction.
We forget that sometimes when we start parsing the texts. You know?
Perhaps.
You get to pick somebody this time.
Oh, I do. Oh, hi. Gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
We have to listen to the testimony of the wise here.
What's your guess as to the relationship between Dhammapada and what the Buddha actually said?
I suspect that quite a lot of the Dhammapada is verbatim Buddha. I suspect that some of it is the ancient Indian equivalent of a stitch in time saves nine. You know, just sayings that were around in the culture at the time, and that were recorded, and people thought that the Buddha said them. There's one particular thing that's in the Dhammapada. I can't remember exactly what it is now. That interestingly, the Buddha is asked about in one of the suttas, and he mentions that this particular saying was an ancient saying that predated him. So he was basically passing on a bit of common lore. It wasn't something that he originated. So, I'd imagine that some of it is like that. One of the interesting things about the Dhammapada is that although scholars say it's in particularly archaic Pali, it was one of the last scriptures to be written down. And why would that be? And I'm guessing it's because they got all the systematic teachings down, and then there are all these bits and pieces floating around in the culture. Oh, the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. And it's like, oh, well, let's collect all of those and we'll put them together and we'll kind of roughly group them into a number of chapters. But the trouble is that, 200 or 300 years after the Buddha, the Buddha said might not have very much meaning, because, well, we've got all these Buddha quotes, fake Buddha quotes floating around right now, the Buddha said. So possibly the Dhammapada is largely a collection of fake Buddha quotes. Or partly, I shouldn't say largely, but partly a collection of fake Buddha quotes.
I mean, which text do you feel come especially close in your guess?
I have no idea, really. I mean, When I'm doing my fake Buddha quote thing, all I'm trying to do is find out whether things are in the Pali Canon or not. If they're not in the Pali Canon, then there's no justification for saying the Buddha said this particular thing. Whether the Buddha actually did say those things, I have absolutely no way of knowing. I mentioned the Sutta Nipata earlier, which seems to have this really kind of beautiful aesthetic quality to it, and is also in quite ancient Pali, which suggests that it might be closer to the way that people actually spoke when they were having dialogues, when the Buddha was actually teaching. But, you know, that's just a guess.
You know, I wonder what you think of this Bodhipaksha, because, again, Stephen Batchelor's new book is coming out in November. He has a particular way, I mean, to address your question of a particular methodology for how to determine what he considered to be truly Buddhist an original Buddhist idea, or what the Buddha said. And what he essentially does is strip away all those things that were all already part of the cultural framework at the time of the Buddha's life, and to look at those things that are departures or that were not found in the culture. Mm-hmm. So his particular understanding of karma, which Bodhipaksha explains so well, or his particular understanding of, say, the three fires, anger, greed, and delusion, which were formerly the three fires of the Hindu household. I mean, he takes those metaphors that are available to him and expresses new ideas. So this is a problematic view according to many scholars, but Stephen's no dummy. I mean, he has spent a lot of time reading the canon, and those ideas that are new or divergent from the prevailing view at the time, he considers to be probably the Buddha's teachings. Now, I mean, does that mean, for instance, when you look at Jesus and say, well, God was an idea that was already prevalent, therefore it's not relevant to his teachings? Well, I mean, that's would be somebody arguing against what Stephen is doing. But it is very interesting whether you agree with him or not. And he does have a way of teasing out what he thinks is consistent and makes sense, given the Buddha's original teachings, as he describes, and his emphasis is on a very pragmatic, practice-oriented, ethical way of living, as opposed to some ideological or ontological or phenomenological approach, you know, to the world. So, but I can give you a copy if you're in New York.
I'd love to.
Yeah. Thank you. It's called After Buddhism. I think it appears in November. And we just did an interview with him. But I recommend getting the book, whether you agree with Stephen's methodology or not. It's certainly original. I mean, Analio simply disagrees with him, and they have a friendly exchange. Analio says, these are beautiful ideas, but there's just no justification for them in the canon. Yeah. You know,
well,
but
I mean, we know that there are things that the Buddha taught. We presume that he taught them that predated him. I mean, there's the formless spheres, which he practiced with Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta. And he didn't get enlightened, you know, using those particular meditation methods. And later, you know, after doing the asceticism thing, he stumbled on jhana and realized that that was the way he was going to get enlightened. But he still, you know, taught those, allowed them, taught them, seemed to encourage them. I assume because they were useful, you know, even if they didn't actually lead him to enlightenment, perhaps they were preparatory in some way.
Yeah, it's funny. With Stephen's book, it will be controversial, and it is very interesting, and it is very innovative and creative. Our copy editor started flipping out when she was reading the interview, saying, this is not possible, because we become very attached to our traditional understanding.
Yeah. I like iconoclasm.
Okay. Hi. You spoke earlier about karma from previous lifetimes, and I didn't quite get it. Even though I must say I don't believe in reincarnation, but I thought it was a central part of Buddhism to believe that, to explain the unfairness in life citing, well, what you did in a previous lifetime.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, and as you said, this leads us to terrible, terrible conclusions. I once asked in a Tibetan Buddhist school, and I don't know if there are differences in the different schools, but I said, for example, what's going on in Africa that these warring tribes come in and they rape the women and throw the babies into the fire. And, you know, how can you explain that? And they really believe, they said, you know, well, she must have done something in a previous lifetime to. And I said that this was very offensive and very upsetting. And what they said was, well, it should be upsetting because then it motivates you to, because you can change your karma by, you know, being on the path. But I find it is a very, aside from being upsetting, it's very offensive. And could you please review what you believe Buddha said about karma, and especially what karma from previous lives?
Well, he did say things like, you could become poor because of, you know, actions in a previous life, but he never said that everyone who is poor because of stuff that they did in a previous life. Yeah, it's quite a difference. From my understanding of the early Buddhist tradition, with their notion of five different interweaving strands of conditionality, which are called the niyamas, which is not found in the Pali canon, but it's found in the early commentarial text. Things like inequality could be explained in other terms that have got nothing to do with karma. It's just part of the way human beings behave, the way that societies emerge, that they set up conditions whereby, you know, wealth becomes concentrated in the hands of a few people. So you can't blame poor people for not having money. You could blame the rich people for not letting them have any money or taking it all away from them. Yeah, I don't think there's any kind of justification in the Pali Canon. I don't think the Buddha had that kind of view that, you know, everything that happens to us is the result of our previous karma. And I think it's a potentially very damaging way of looking at things. I mean, you've already talked about what could be a lack of compassion. I have heard about Buddhists who have refused to get involved in practicing medicine because then they'd be helping sick people, and the sick people are sick because of the previous karma, so you would be interfering with their karma. I mean, what? There's a saying misattributed to somebody or other, if we believe absurdities, we commit atrocities. Whoever it is that's attributed to never actually said it, because I remember trying to find out whether they did, but it's true. If we believe things that are crazy, you know, we end up doing, you know, crazy and damaging things.
Can I ask, do you think that this was a particularly, something about this particular school, or is Tibetan Buddhism, is this something that they teach in Tibetan Buddhism as opposed to the other?
Yeah. Tibetan Buddhism is quite separated historically from the Pali texts, and even from the Buddha as a historical individual. I think you could have gone to Tibet 100 years ago, and there are so many different, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You would find Buddhists there who didn't really know anything much about the historical Buddha. They know a lot about, you know, Vajrapani and Avalokiteshvara and whatnot, but the historical Buddha they perhaps didn't really know about, and they certainly didn't have contact with his texts. So, you know, the particular understanding that's arisen within Tibetan Buddhism is that everything that happens is the result of karma. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Tibetan Buddhists, as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't necessarily mean that they actually follow that through and be uncompassionate. Because I think compassion is just a very powerful human force. And so, and most Tibetans that I've met have been very warm, compassionate people. And they're not going to be walking along the roadside and walking along the sidewalk and seeing a poor beggar and thinking, well, I'm not going to help that person because he must have done something in a past life to deserve that. They're just going to have a compassionate response and want to do something. So I think the actual human experience of compassion overrides that kind of rather narrow and potentially damaging way of looking at things.
You know, isn't it true though that the Gay Lukes in particular do not consider karma the sole determinant of a person's fate? I mean, I don't believe the Gaylooks think that.
I don't know. All I can say is that I've heard this coming from Tibetan teachers quite.
Well, you know, yeah, I hear Tibetans talking about the situation in Tibet as a karmic kind of comeuppance. Yeah. They tend to do that more, but within the Tibetan tradition, there are factors other than karma that determine fate.
Yeah, the Tibetan. There are lots of different Tibetan traditions, and that may well be the case. I don't know.
But they emphasize that more, right?
That's good. Yeah. It's good to hear that there are other ways.
But I'm agreeing with you that the tendency to attribute things to karma is much greater than it is, say.
Yeah.
Good evening. Thank you. I've got a statement and a kind of question. I was raised Catholic, Christian. I believe, or I'd like to believe in Jesus as a historical person. Compassion, bring the children, sat with the poor. And then the more I read, I got into Buddhism about 6 years ago, and I read a lot. And maybe Jesus didn't exist, or maybe he didn't teach what he taught. And so I'm questioning, I'm trying to kind of bring Buddhism and my upbringing together and find out where the path is. So I said to my son, you know, I'm having these issues with, he says, what do you care? So believe in Jesus. If he embodies what you want to be, and believe in Jesus. You know, maybe that's why we want to believe. It's conditioning. I was raised, you know, Catholic. But maybe that's why we want to believe in the Buddha as a historical being, because it's something we can lay our passion upon. And it's even easier at that point. You can see the icon and you can move on. The Buddha, in the Buddha's time, again, with the readings, you don't know what you to believe or not to believe, but supposedly there was a lot of awakenings in the Buddha time. And the awakenings taught new people to awaken. Jesus did a lot of healing, and the people about him, when he was gone, the disciples healed a lot of people. You don't find people, or you don't hear about people awakening today, and you don't see people walking around healing. Are they stories, or was there something lost in the translation that we've lost the ability to awaken like they did, or to heal like Jesus did?
I think there's lots of awakening happening. Actually,
sign me up.
Right. You know, I've heard this a lot, and, you know, certainly different people look at it differently. A lot of people say, well, I'm not seeing anybody who's enlightened. What happened? Did it never really happen, or are we less inclined? But Bodhipaksha here says there's a lot of awakening. And all I can say is that I've had contact with teachers who have been practicing for decades, who certainly have far more wisdom than I do. They're far more open. They're far more compassionate than I am. And I don't concern myself terribly about whether they're awakened in the sort of mythical sense that we understand it. I mean, how many people are Christ-like? I mean, I grew up a Catholic too. How many people are Christ-like? And you do find, in fact, people within that tradition who come very close to embodying an ideal that I was taught about. And I agree with Bodhipaksha, there is a lot of awakening, and there are teachers who are very realized. But in the Buddhist tradition, it's highly uncommon, in fact, taboo to declare oneself enlightened. If somebody tells you they're enlightened, we'd be rather suspicious, would we not?
Well, actually, again, this is one of these things that people say, that it's like against some kind of Buddhist rule to say you're enlightened.
Well, it seems
people
to be.
It all the time,
right, but
in the Pali Canon.
Right, all the time in the Pali Canon. But in the Buddhist traditions today, how many people say, I'm enlightened?
Yeah, well, the thing is, if you say that, I mean, how does it help? How does it help people?
Well, I mean, in the Pali Canon, it helps because there are examples of people who achieved enlightenment. But
it seems like an
ego trip if someone says it otherwise. I mean, I guess one protects against...
Well, if they've lost their ego, then it's not an ego trip. But
If they say it, you may think they have an ego.
You might think they do, yeah. I mean, it's a two-edged sword. It can be inspiring to know that people have had awakening experiences. And there are lots of people who have had awakening experiences. And you need to bear in mind that there's a spectrum of awakening experiences that you can have in Buddhism. And I go by the traditional Pali canon, you know, stream entrant, once returner, never returner, arahant. I know loads of people that are stream entrants. It's not that uncommon at all. I asked around, you know, some of my friends to say, well, okay, is there anyone here who thinks they're beyond a stream entrant? And, you know, one person I know, well, I say I knew him quite well when I lived in Britain. You know, he was telling me about his experiences of being a non-returner. And I was very interested in that because if you've had the experience of stream entry, well, where do you go from now? It's not as if there's a lot of guidance about, you know, what exactly should I be working on next? And he was able to say, oh, you're right, this is what I've been working on and this is what's been working for me. So that's really good. So anyway, it can be really useful. But the thing is, if someone comes to you and says, well, are you awakened? And I say, yeah, okay, well, I could say, I'm a stream entrant. Well, what difference does that actually make to your life? Do you believe now that I'm a stream entrant just because I've said I'm a stream entrant? You'd have to, you know, like watch and say, well, what does this actually mean? We'd have to get into a dialogue about what this actually means. And then you'd still have the question of, well, is he actually telling the truth? Maybe he's deluded. So it doesn't necessarily help.
I think, though, that people do, I know of three or four people, I don't know them personally, but I read what they write and I see them online, and they have declared themselves enlightened, and they're reacting to the taboo that they feel is oppressive. Yeah. But to declare oneself enlightened is uncommon among Buddhists. Generally, they allow their students or friends to say, this is an enlightened master, but they themselves don't say it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people are saying somebody is enlightened, and I've come across this countless times and where I sit, and the person is doing all sorts of things we would consider horribly unethical, and yet their students will continue to call them enlightened. So the question really becomes, what is enlightenment, and how does that manifest, and what does it, and what we would we expect of a person's behavior? And in different traditions, there are different expectations.
I feel like perhaps I shouldn't say anything because I'm not as learned as some or well-read as so many people in this room, but I feel compelled as a budding Tibetan Buddhist to say something about karma. And as a Jewish Buddhist, I never understood how people could say, well, what about the Holocaust? How could you say that's karmically deserved, you know, and that really was my big one question. And it's becoming less and less important to me because I understand in a certain budding way that there's a lack of judgment involved. It's not that something's bad or something's good. One thing leads to another in some unexpressible way. You know, I'm starting to see that there's a lack of judgment, if that makes any sense.
And I think it does. I think it's what I was talking about, the intersection of genuine human compassion, I think overrides that particular view. So even if people are saying, yes, I think these people must have done something, you know, karmically to have got into that situation, they don't feel hatred because they've also been developing compassion. But I still think the view is wrong.
Yeah.
And it can potentially lead into inaction toward social issues. I think that's very common. And also it could potentially lead to making quite harsh judgments.
I see that as a definite possibility.
Yeah.
And because we live in a dichotomous world where you sort of see things as black and white. But what I'm getting is that even if somebody did something, like Hitler, Hitler, we have compassion for Hitler, you know? I mean, we don't have compassion for Hitler, but I don't have compassion for Hitler, if I'm honest. But I do feel like he was brought up in a world that made him who he is. And on a certain level, there's just a lack of judgment. If someone does something that we think is terrible, there's an idea that we don't blame that person. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't blame that person because that person is coming from a certain place, and that we're learning from every single experience that we have.
Yeah.
So whether it seems like the experience is dire, we're still learning from it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's hard for me to put it into words, but
yeah.
I'm getting less of a judgment
yeah.
feeling about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I wondered if there was much you believe that was substantial doctrine that was taught by the Buddha but not codified in the Pali Canon. Like, if there are specifics on that, that would be really interesting.
If there were things that were taught by the Buddha that aren't in the Pali Canon.
Yeah, that
yeah.
were not codified, that were lost.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess, you know, people have been doing this for thousands of years, like disputing what the Buddha actually said, and they're
yeah.
developing interpretations,
yeah.
monks, lay people.
Yeah.
What's interesting about us doing it in this time here? You know, is there something really interesting yeah. about the modern way of doing it with the internet or at universities or here in the West or basically?
I kind of lost the last part there, but yeah, things that the Buddha taught that perhaps aren't in the Pali Canon. I mentioned Shunyata as one of those. I think that was probably a very deep teaching of his that most people could not understand. Only, you know, certain really serious practitioners could understand. And you have to remember that right in the early days there was a division of labor in the Buddhist monastic sangha. This is referred to in the Pali Canon, that there were some monks who specialized in memorizing the teachings and passing them on, and there were other monks that specialized in meditation. And there were tensions between these two different wings in the Sangha. Now, who's passing on the teachings? Obviously, it's the ones who are memorizing the teachings, but they're passing on teachings which are about meditation and about states that can only really be experienced if you have a really deep meditation practice. So can you really understand and pass on the nuances of the teachings if you're not doing the meditation practice? I don't think you can. So I think what tended to happen was that certain teachings that were, you know, more profound got passed on in a very fragmentary, piecemeal kind of a way. I think Shunyata is one of them. I think there's a lost Buddhist teaching, thank you, of non-duality. My brain is a little foggy since I've been awake since about 4 o'clock this morning and spent 6 hours on buses to get here. But Bahia, that's his name. A practitioner called Bahia of the Bark Garment, who was not a Buddhist disciple, but who thought he was awakened, got a kind of a message from his intuition that he wasn't in fact awakened, and what he really needed to do was go and talk to the Buddha. And he pestered the Buddha. Again, he did this asking the Buddha 3 times. The Buddha was on his arms round and kept saying to Bahia, please come and talk to me later. You know, I'm on my arms round. But Bahia insisted on asking 3 times, and he said, look, there might not be a later. You know, existence is fragile. Anything could happen. And the Buddha said, okay, I'll give you this teaching. And he gave this teaching of, you know, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard. Very famous teaching. And people tend to see this as being, you know, just be with your experience, don't elaborate on it. But he went on to say some quite interesting things about how if in the seen, there's only the seen. If in the heard, there is only the heard. And if in the cognized, there is only the cognized. Then there's no you there. There's no you in here. There's no you out there. There's no you in between. And I think that's pointing to a teaching of experiential non-duality. Not that the Buddha was teaching an ontological oneness, but that when you completely drop your sense of self, when you completely stop selfing, there is just this kind of unified field of experience which is out there and in here, and you're just not making any distinction about, oh yeah, this bit is me and that bit is you. So, which leads to compassion, because there's this suffering that needs to be responded to, and it doesn't matter whether the suffering is out there or whether the suffering is in here, one just responds to it. So anyway, non-duality is one. I think probably there were more teachings on spiritual friendship that didn't get passed on. It's quite extraordinary that the Buddha says that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life, and then there's actually not that much about spiritual friendship in the Pali Canon. And I think probably, again, just because of the dynamic of the way that the teachings were passed on, it was the monks that passed on the teachings, and they possibly weren't even there when the Buddha was teaching lay people some of the time, and didn't pass on teachings that were given to the lay people, or maybe just didn't see them as being as important because they weren't directly relevant to their lives. So I suspect that there were a lot of things that the Buddha said to lay people which weren't passed on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.